all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's sort of like an economic Pearl Harbor attack on Mason City and Saratoga County.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Later in the hour, I share my conversation with Vic Moss, looking back on his career in the social services, including 29 years as the director of Emergency Residence Project. Vic announced recently that, well past the usual retirement age, he is stepping down from this position. We will hear some of the reasons why. We will also welcome into the studio two church ladies from St. Cecilia Catholic Church. Yes, they get together and sew, but you might be surprised to find out exactly what they are sewing. But now, I bring you the voices of Central Iowans, such as the one you heard in our intro. The residents of Mason City were dealt a harsh blow on March 21st, when the papers reported that Prestige Foods of North Carolina had negotiated with the Mason City mayor, Eric Buchmeier, to bring a 10,000 per day kill hog processing plant to their town. Not only that, they heard that Prestige would be receiving a tax abatement from their city to the tune of $14 million, with state taxpayers chipping in another $13 million. Last Tuesday was the second of three public hearings required by law for the council to pass the tax abatement. This reporter watched the entire five-hour meeting online. The perfect way to spend a sick day in bed. And I bring to you excerpts of the drama and passion that filled the room, highlighting the major issues. The first person to speak was Chad Schreck, the president of the North Iowa Corridor Economic Development Corporation. This organization includes the communities of both Clear Lake and Mason City and Cerro Gordo County, which they are both part of.
The point of tonight, like the mayor said, is to really go through the details of the project, talk through some of the due diligence that's been done as we've been going through this process over the last 4 months with our partners at the state, at the city, at the corridor, and beyond.
Despite Chad Schreck's reference to the corridor group as a partner, it became clear in the weeks after the official announcement that leaders of Clear Lake and Cerro Gordo County had not been told of Mayor Eric Buchmeier's negotiations with Prestige, and this did not sit well with many of the audience members. There was a sense that a secret had been kept from them, and indeed it had, for the 3 months between Prestige's official inquiry on December 18th and its official announcement on March 21st.
I was told that you guys worked with the corridor here, but then I'm finding out that Clear Lake wasn't contacted, the county supervisors weren't contacted, so I'm trying to figure out who you coordinated all this with. If you guys were actually doing this. I mean, if I was left out of this particular project and you didn't get my input, I would think I'd be looking at getting out of the corridor and no longer participating, because that's a slap in the face.
At issue for those communities, of course, is the reality that building that much capacity for hog processing in North Iowa. Keep in mind that Sioux City is just finishing construction of a similar size plant, will create a kind of vacuum which hog confinements, or CAFOs, will rush in to fill. Ron Prestige, the North Carolinian owner of Prestige Foods, was at the meeting and did his best to reverse this kind of thinking.
There's a misconception that a new plant means that there's a requirement for new farms in order to supply it. That is absolutely untrue, and let me just tell you what the numbers are. First of all, there are three different kinds of hog farms in my world. There's company-owned, and my family has a lot of company-owned farms. Most of our sow farms, we have turkeys in North and South Carolina, hogs in North Carolina, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, Oklahoma, and Iowa. We have sows in all of them except for Iowa. Second kind of farm is what we call a contract farm. And that's essentially where a farmer signs a contract to grow pigs that I own. He owns the barns. I pay him to raise the pigs. I provide the feed. He has no market risk. He's essentially guaranteed that he'll be profitable. And the third type of hog farm is an independent producer. The plant that we're proposing, First Shift, will require 50,000 market hogs a week, 10,000 a shift, 5 days a week. If the plant gets double shifted, that number would double to 100,000 a week. That works out to be 2.5 million market hogs a year for one shift, 5 million if you double shift the plant. Prestige has 700,000 finishing spaces in Iowa today. We've been in Iowa for 12 years. Over 50% of the market hogs required for the first shift are pigs that I currently own today. And instead of taking them to different packers, we would take them to our own plant. I already have the interest, and if I wanted to get ahead of myself, could get the commitments to procure the market hogs necessary to finish the first shift right now. Now, that means that they're interested in selling to me instead of selling to a different packer that they're currently selling to. They think that the competition this plant will bring will be good for them. It's that simple.
But the standing room only audience at the Mason City Council meeting wasn't buying this line of reasoning.
I still don't understand the numbers, sir. I don't understand. You're saying you've got the hogs out there that are currently going to other processors, correct? Now you're going to take them away from there. Now those guys got to fill that gap. So maybe he's not building CAFOs because he's got the hogs available, he says. But they're already being processed somewhere. Now what are they going to do? They're going to close? So somebody, it doesn't jive. There's going to be CAFOs somewhere. And they're going to dump that manure. Every hog produces 11 pounds of manure a day, okay? And you're talking millions of them. That poop's got to go somewhere, folks. It goes on the fields. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the fear of the CAFOs.
Indeed, a Des Moines Register article quoted an independent analytic firm saying that the combination of the two plants would require a supply of 8 to 9 million more pigs a year to reach capacity. Largely because of its tourist attraction, Clear Lake, Cerro Gordo County used to be one of the lead counties fighting CAFOs. Its supervisors passed a moratorium on building more CAFOs in 2002, just a couple of months before Senate File 2293 took that authority away from counties, established a unified master matrix scoring system, and gave ultimate control to the state DNR. CAFO fighting runs deep in these people's blood. The incentives that the state and city are handing out were not overlooked by the people in the audience. On top of the $14 million in tax abatements that Mason City offered Prestige, there are other costs that were newly revealed at Tuesday night's meeting. The city engineer described a two-stage process of upgrading the water supply that would require digging 4 new wells, creating new water main connections, adding pumps, storage and filtration systems, and possibly even an additional plant with a price tag of $35.4
million. $35 million in tax dollars here, new tax dollars that I wasn't aware of, $35 million. We've already going to give them $27 million between the state and the city, right? Aren't you a multi-billion dollar outfit? I don't know about anybody else in this room. Aren't you all getting kind of tired of corporate welfare, giving millions of dollars to billion-dollar companies? Huh? Okay, so here's the deal. This company is leaving North Carolina because the water is totally polluted down there, okay? In North Carolina is third worst water in the United States. And if nobody's noticed, we've got a severe problem with water quality in this state.
Yes, Virginia. There is a Santa Claus. And yes, North Carolina has established a moratorium on new hog confinements. As can be expected, there were also voices demanding realism of a different kind. North Central Iowa is agriculture country. In this next clip, a grain farmer refers to Phyllis Willis from 20 miles away, who also testified at the meeting. Her her husband, Paul Willis, helped create the market for Nyman Ranch pork, the pasture-raised Berkshire hogs that have become the toast of elite eaters in San Francisco and around the nation.
This particular project is part of the food system. It's part of the animal agriculture we have. Animal agriculture consumes those products that I raise. And Mrs. Willis, God bless you for what you've done. I have many friends who are raising Berkshires for Nyman Ranch, and they love it. And I also have many friends that are raising hogs in the current conventional system, and they love it.
The steady decline of Mason City's population year after year, and especially the exodus of its young people, was a consistent theme of the hearing. Ironically, the heyday of the town, back in the 1960s and early 70s, was when a long-established, old-fashioned pork processing plant called Decker's, although by then it had long been owned by Armour, paid its workers $17 an hour. The workers who will be hired by Prestige some 40 or 50 years later will be making $15 at most.
When Decker's closed up, a lot of my friends moved away with their families to Texas, to Fort Dodge, different places that Armour had facilities. They didn't come back. You know, we lost a lot of population. This is a chance to get our population back.
As another audience member of the Mason City Council meeting pointed out, not all communities are that nostalgic about the meatpacking plants they have lost.
I was told today from a city council member that Isle Falls was approached by Prestige to put this plant in Isle Falls. Isle Falls has a huge project going right now, a residential housing project like you guys would like to do, to bring in business. What a perfect situation. Isle Falls turned it down. Back in the 90s, XL tried coming into Isle Falls. With the bad experience of Farmland Foods that was there, the building is there still, the roof's caving in, weeds growing up through it. It's a junkyard. No wonder why Isle Falls didn't want to bring it in. XL tried coming in the 90s. The city shot it down. The city shot down Prestige again. Why? If this is such a good opportunity for the cities of Iowa, why did Isle Falls turn it down?
Much of the rest of the testimony regarded the population that was expected to follow the plant into town. The plant is expected to hire 1,000 people for the first shift and another 1,000 when it expands.
I'm going to start out just by reading a little blurb from a Frontline show that was on television called Inside the Slaughterhouse, and it kind of addresses the economic development piece. This is what one of the people that they interviewed said. There's been a lot of technological advances in slaughterhouses. And he went on and talked about some of those. And then he said, but one of the problems is the high turnover rate among workers in these plants. The industry averages anywhere from 75 to 100% turnover rate a year, which means a constant flow of workers in and out of these jobs. And so as the city's trying to prepare for this, my question would be, you have an unstable, substantial unstable workforce. How are you going to prepare for that?
The anticipated burden on Mason City schools was the main reason that a number of citizens attended.
I haven't heard anyone in the Mason City public school system telling how they're planning to handle this. I don't have a hard number, but I think we have about 3,000 kids in the public schools here. And with 2,000 workers, I don't understand how they're going to be able to pull that off, even in a best case scenario.
I am very disappointed that there's nobody here representing the schools talking about how they're prepared to handle an influx of kids who very likely will be English as a second language students. Culturally, it would be fabulous to have a more diverse group of people in our town. I am not opposed to that. Don't hear me say that. What I am saying is there is a potential for people who will come and cause things like this. Towns that have meatpacking plants, all of their schools, all of their grade levels, the children, on average, test 2 years below grade level. And that's in all towns with meatpacking plants. So that's an issue for me. We also talk about housing. I can tell you, as an owner and a landlord of 23 single-family rental homes, I don't have a single one open, and I rarely do. And I have people who find out about a house and say, oh my gosh, I've been looking for months. I can't find anything, because it doesn't exist unless you want to live in a dump. Am I going to build a house or redo a home so I can house 12 people in a two-bedroom house? No, thank you. I am not. My husband runs a business here in this town also. We are not opposed to changes, but we are opposed to the way changes are being done.
Once again, these were voices from the April 5th Mason City Council meeting, the second of three public hearings required before the council can vote on a $14 million package in tax abatements, along with a $35 million package of required infrastructure improvements to allow the Prestige hog processing plant to operate. Many citizens urged the council to put the issue up for a public referendum, as they had done several years ago for a casino, but none of the council members took up that request in their closing comments. The third of the required hearings is scheduled for April 21st, and an additional one and final one will likely be held May 3rd. Certainly, the people of Mason City and Cerro Gordo County are facing some difficult issues at this important crossroads in their development. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. In the studio now are two Ames residents working on another kind of development entirely. We in the developed world, or perhaps I should say we women in the developed world, take our disposable sanitary products for granted. In sub-Saharan Africa and other poverty-stricken regions of the world, women often don't have such products at their disposal. Some women of St. Cecilia Catholic Church in Ames and also Cornerstone Church have plugged into a nationwide effort called Days for Girls. And Mary Ross and Carol Helland are here to tell us about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So why doesn't one of you tell us how Days for Girls was first presented to you and how you decided it was something you wanted to pursue?
I first learned about Days for Girls at the Iowa State Fair almost 2 years ago now from the Blessman Ministries booth at the Varied Industries building. At that time, I was making, as a lot of women I think have across our country and in the city of Ames, the little dresses for Africa, and found out from them, from Blessman, that while those were they, which is not to say all other areas have enough of those little dresses, but they did at that point, but they had another sewing opportunity. So then they explained to me this whole Days for Girls organization and the need for washable, reusable, feminine sanitary supplies. So I started very small, just downloaded the instructions from the website and started making them myself, then got into contact with someone else from Blessman Ministries who came by the house with some samples of items that had been made just so I could check and make sure I was making them correctly, and so it sort of went from there. Got in contact with a lady from Des Moines, Kay Hertz, who is extremely involved with this organization, probably one of the first in the state who became familiar with Days for Girls and then started making things. And it's just sort of gone from there.
And the name of the ministry?
It's Blessman Ministries. It's based in Urbandale. Their ministry is in South Africa, in Limpopo province, South Africa, which is the northernmost province. And that is where all of our kits go that we make, or the vast majority of the kits that we make at St. Cecilia every month. That's where they go.
And then, Mary, you found out about it.
Yeah, we St. Cecilia works with Holy Family Cluster out of Clarion, Eagle Grove, et cetera. And Monica, who is a nurse and goes on medical mission trips, told me they were making some. She said it was on the Internet, so I looked it up and I found all the information. If you go to the Internet, it tells you which teams are where and who to contact. So I contacted Kay and Carol, and they answered like within 24 hours. So I thought, well, this is really good because these people are really enthused. I think Carol invited us over to her house to see what she had done. So we went over. And then St. Cecilia has a time and talent survey where you check what you might want, be interested in doing. So I went to the parish office and I got the list of everybody that checked sewing for the last, I don't know how many years. Some people were no longer with us, actually. But anyway, it was a list. So I asked all those people. And we started in April last year. And at the time, I thought, well, they're just going to want to sew at home, you know, half an hour at night here and there. But they all wanted to get together. So we meet on the second Tuesday of the month. It's supposed to start at 7, but they start arriving by 6:30 or so. But, yeah, they really enjoy getting together and talking and sewing and serging. And we have a number of people who don't sew at all. And they come and they cut out pattern pieces, or they cut the ribbon for the drawstring bags, or they put kits together. So we have people that are like professional seamstresses, I mean, that altered clothes for a living in the past. And we have people who haven't sewn since high school and still haven't. And then we have people who don't sew at all. So we have a whole spectrum of people that come and sew or put together kits.
Okay, you mentioned serging. That's really a specific kind of machine that will finish the edge.
If you look at a lot of the clothes that you buy in the store, if you look at the edge, you can kind of tell it's an overcast stitch, and it's much more durable. And Days for Girls wants the liners to be serged because they want these kits to last for 3 years. So it lasts much longer than just zigzagging. And actually, one of the members of our team got a serger donated. She asked on one of those Ames Facebook pages, and somebody gave her their mom's serger, and she's taught herself, and she's serged hundreds of them.
Surging away.
Yeah.
So how did the church ladies react when you presented this opportunity?
They were really excited. Like I said, they wanted to get together, but they are sewing on their own, too. As of this month, we probably are close to 600 kits, which every kit gets 8 liners with a hot spot down the middle. So that's, I mean, they are sewing a lot on their own.
Yes. Okay, and a hot spot would be extra padding. Let's take a look at the demo that you brought. Both of you brought one. So there's a kind of attractive calico bag.
They like the bags to be bright and pretty because the girls are like bright and pretty things, just like our girls do. So
okay.
And there's an instruction sheet.
Okay.
And every one illustrated. Because we have all languages.
This shows how to insert the pad into
a shield.
The shield is the piece of the kit that has a moisture-proof barrier between the two layers of cotton. It's called PUL, polyurethane laminate.
Right. They use that in diapers when you have reusable diapers.
Exactly. Lots of times in the fabric stores, you'll find it in the baby section. So that is between the two layers of cotton, and then
And then I see these. Flannel. They're flannel, double-sided flannel kind of washcloths that are used as folded over, are used as the pads.
Mm-hmm.
And this one has two of those in there.
They can put up to three
for heavy flow.
Shield. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the snaps are for snapping around the underwear, right?
Under the underpants, yes.
Okay. Carol's husband does all of those
snaps. My husband has become the official snapper.
Well, that's good. That means everybody doesn't have to buy one of those snap kits.
Right.
And we aren't actually putting the underwear in the kits, although Days for Girls does do that. Blessman Ministries, Dr. Blessman has assured us that he can get underwear donated. I mean, if we get it, we pass it on. But since he's said that, he would rather we sew because he can't buy that.
Right.
So
okay.
We are.
Oh, and then there is a washcloth.
There is. He explains hygiene and their periods and everything to them.
There's a bar of soap.
A bar of soap.
Mm-hmm. So this gentleman from Urbandale goes to Limpopo District and talks to girls about menstruation?
They have a major mission there in South Africa. It's a multifaceted. They have a huge feeding program. They are involved in the feeding of 7,000 people a day. He is a medical doctor, so there, you know, it's a medical mission. They have an eyeglass ministry, a shoe ministry. They are working on sustainable farming. Iowa State University is involved with that. I believe it's Des Moines University that stands students over there to work with people and learn about things, diseases that they'll probably never encounter in our country. So it's a multifaceted mission.
And obviously there was a need for this kind of thing. And can you share what you know about the kind of the cultural response to menstruation in South Africa or the various places where Days for Girls operates?
We have been told that girls and young women in these underdeveloped countries simply don't have the products available to them for their monthly periods, so they will end up using things like corn stalks, mattress stuffing, leaves,
tree bark,
yes, to absorb the flow. And what happens is that so many of the girls simply don't go to school for those 4 or 5 days or don't go to work, which then, if you think about it, would have a major impact on their education or the supporting of their family if they can't go to work. So hence the name of the organization, Days for Girls. By providing these kits for them, it is in effect giving them days back for their lives that they can continue their education. The goal of Days for Girls is incredible. That is that every girl and woman in the world will have access to these products. I'm not sure what the year is, what their goal is for that. And they've already reached up girls in 100 countries, and I believe almost 250,000 kits have been distributed so far through local teams all across the United States. I think we have about 10 teams possibly in Iowa.
So you're doing this tomorrow evening at St. Cecilia's.
Correct.
7 o'clock, but you can come early. And do people bring their sewing machines or?
Yes, people bring their sewing machines and their sergers and their cutting boards and their rotary cutters. But we have one lady donated, an elderly lady donated her sewing machine, so we have one there. And we share whatever we're bringing. So if you don't bring a machine, you could bring it next time, or you could do one of the things that the non-sewers do. So.
And also you obviously need materials.
Yeah, we have had such generous donations. We've had sewing team members donate things. Quilting Connection donated a lot of PUL at the beginning. One of our parishioners donated, we approximated about 400 yards of quilter's cotton. Her mother had been a quilter and taught classes. She didn't want her name used, but we're almost through that because we've made so many kits. But we have had a lot of donations, but we don't get a lot, like of the flannel donated or the PUL. So we can use that and also cash donations to pay for the fray check and the ribbon and the Ziploc bags. They use those because they're the freezer bags because they last 3 years. So we can always use donations for the different materials that we use.
Okay, and you can catch the sales on flannel, buy bright colors.
They have some regulations cultural because the cultures are different. Like stars is a cult in Africa, so we can't have anything with stars or war or camouflage. Some of the religions, they won't wear anything with animals or bugs and things like that. So if you go to the website, it will tell you what we cannot use.
Well, this is a fabulous project, and thank you so much, Mary Ross of St. Cecilia's and Carol Helland of Cornerstone Church. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
When we come back, my conversation with Vic Moss, Director of Emergency Residence Shelter for 29 years, on his history in Ames and his upcoming retirement.
Love scars, love wounds, and mars any heart not tough nor strong enough.
classic tune covered by many, the Everly Brothers, was the first. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. My next guest certainly does have a heart tough and strong enough. He has lived a life of love in this community through acts of empathy and service. He's shown respect to all who come through the door of the Ames Homeless Shelter. In a few months, Vic Moss, well over the normal retirement age, will step down from his role as director. I had him in the studio yesterday to talk about his early years in Ames and also what he hopes to do in the future. So 29 years ago, 1987, you became the shelter director, and you are already in your late 30s or early 40s?
Early 40s.
So tell us a little about your career before the shelter. What had you done? What kind of degree did you get from college, and how did you start off in life?
Well, it's kind of a convoluted path. I became interested in issues of social justice back when I was still in college, and I pretty much did an about-face in my academic career. I was going to be a wildlife biologist and got pretty close to having that finished, and then the Vietnam War was there, and it just seemed like I wanted to do something that I considered relevant. And even though I didn't feel like I was a natural for being involved with a lot of other people, I really like my time alone, and that's why a biologist seemed like a pretty nice career. But I thought sometimes you should go against type, and I decided I'm going to try this. I had some curiosity about just what happens, you know, why growing up schoolmates in a town that had had some major economic problems where a huge railroad had pulled out and taken about half the good jobs, and I saw a lot of things fall apart, and kids I'd grown up with getting in trouble, and yet some of these kids were I considered best friends. That I just kind of wondered what's happening. You know, we all grew up in the same community, but I had no grasp at all what was happening in these lives. And so anyway, that was just kind of that curiosity that led me to social work. At that time, Iowa State didn't have a social work program, so I took social and psych for about 2 years and got enough background and was able to pass the state's merit test or whatever to get licensed as a social worker in Iowa. And pretty much been doing that ever since.
Is that town you grew up in Iowa?
Yeah, it's Northeast Iowa. Owine is the name of the town. It was, for a long time after that, it was known as the meth capital of America. It really was, became a pretty tough town.
Hmm. So you got a degree in?
I actually got a degree in entomology, simply because at one point I had to get out of school. I had just gotten married, had a young son that I needed to start thinking about supporting, so I just went and I took a couple courses and got a degree in that field, but I was close to several others, too.
So your son saved you from being a perpetual student.
Yeah. I had to face the real world, I guess. And I came to Ames that I had no idea I was there at the golden age of housing, because I could get a half-time job at making minimum wage, and I could support myself, pay tuition, and find an apartment for that wage. Some of these apartments weren't that enviable, but I was happy with them, usually having a roommate or two. And these were basement apartments, and what happened then a decade later was there were changes in zoning, and most of the places where I lived became illegal to live in because you have to have two methods of egress for fire safety.
And what was your first job out of college then?
I got a job working for Iowa Department of Human Services in Story County, and I did that for 3 years. And during that time, there was a huge increase in the awareness of child abuse. It was a phenomenon which actually didn't exist, weren't even laws protecting children in many states. In fact, some of the early cases were actually prosecuted using cruelty to animals rules because children were considered property of their parents. They were called their chattel. And parents could basically do anything they wanted to. There were high-profile cases in Des Moines Register of children that were killed. And so the state just decreed that we have to do something. So they named me the child abuse investigator for Story County. with very little training. I had to go and go to a lot of conferences and read and stuff like that, but it really was a new field, and yet I was thrust right into it. And before I knew anything, I had 40-something cases with very few prospects of having much of an effect on these families. And that's when I started discovering some of the underlying issues behind other social problems. Talked to a veteran social worker at one point, and he said, you know, we probably only get about 1% of all the actual cases ever get reported. And he realized, well, if I could solve that 1%, I'd be leaving 99% unsolved. It's hard to imagine anything that doesn't happen to children. I mean, I've dealt with children blind from being shaken. Children that, you know, with broken limbs that were never set, with burns. I had some of the worst cases that a judge said, he said it was the worst he'd ever seen. This is a veteran judge in Iowa. And I realized that this isn't doing it. You know, for one thing, we have to look at risk factors and try to determine what could happen earlier on before these cases happen. And I discovered that stress in the household was one of maybe the biggest risk factor for child abuse to occur. And the biggest sources of stress were economic stress. These are usually families living in poverty. I'm not saying that poverty caused this, because there were some affluent families in which this occurred too, but the incidence is much higher in families living in poverty. The American Humane Association says it's about 20 times as likely to happen in a household with poverty. That figure might be a little high, but it might not, because that was a predominant risk factor that I saw. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the solutions lay in looking at the broader issues of poverty. And
this was back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so I think of that time, and there were fewer families with two incomes. Mm-hmm. It seems there were probably more with a single income. What kind of scenarios did you see when you investigated families that were guilty of child abuse?
They were usually that nobody knew about. They were kind of isolated. And I just thought that child abuse probably doesn't occur in families where you've got strong connections, where you've got parents and grandparents to step in times like. The most common abuser was the mother's boyfriend. I mean, it happened to biological parents, too, but families that were fragmented.
Mm-hmm. And possibly because of the mobility of society. You mentioned the train company mm-hmm. moving out, and a lot of that kind of thing was happening and still happens. So that means people move to another town to find another opportunity, and then they are isolated.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, during the time that I was learning about this and investigating these cases, it was spiking in the cities and what you call the Rust Belt in Pennsylvania and others, where there was a lot of steel mills, and these were closing down. There were huge changes. Good paying jobs were disappearing. And you could see in studies that were done, I remember in Detroit, it almost mirrored the economics of the city, the number of reports that they were getting. And I realized what was happening. These were families. Their world was falling apart. The parents no longer had a way to support their children, and they were living under this enormous stress of, what are they going to do? They can't make their house payments anymore. Or if they're renting, they don't have enough income. And to live under these situations, if you wanted to create a climate in which you wanted abuse to occur, these are the things that you would do. You'd just create instability in the households.
So you worked for the Department of Human Services for
3 years.
3 years. And what next? What came after that?
Well, I went right into working for an organization that it was a treatment center for children with emotional problems. And some of these same cases that I'd investigated, these were children. In fact, I'd actually placed some children in this. It was a group home, basically. Then I worked there for 13 years, and that's where I really saw the effects on the children. And it turned out that, you know, after working with some of these same children whose cases I'd investigated, then being directly with them, and I was working 24-hour shifts, I was getting them up in the morning, putting them in bed at night, and telling them stories and being everything a parent would do. And I realized that most of these kids, they really didn't have what you call an emotional disturbance. They were kids acting normally under abnormal circumstances. They're acting the way any of us would act if we were subjected to the kinds of situations they were living under. And then after 13 years doing that, I came to the shelter, and I guess it shouldn't have been to my surprise, but the first case I'd ever investigated, you know, 20 years earlier, showed up. Now as an adult, all I recognized was a name, and it took me a while, you know, talking with this young man to say, did you used to live in the city of Zeering, as a matter of fact? And yeah, and because I'd been to his house and talked to his mom quite a few times, and he was showing up at school with bruises, that there was no explanation for. And I realized I've done a longitudinal study on poverty and its effects, because now I'm dealing with three jobs, and actually after some of these children had their own children, with three generations too here. Basically, they were getting time away, you might say, from their parents, and there was some involvement with the parents during this time, because often the plan was to return. But fixing children is not that easy, especially in the short term. But I got to see some of them just blossom once some of these stresses disappeared. I was a real believer in nature as being the best psychiatrist. And I'd take the kids out every weekend to different walking trails. And we learned how to forage for the food and stuff like that and make clay pots out of the clay sticking out of a riverbank, and Back at where I was, they were just driving people crazy. And there, they were little Indians. They were no trouble at all to manage. I just had to try to keep them in sight, I'd advise this for anybody, simply because I really do think that it's a pretty amazing world out there, and a lot of us don't appreciate it enough.
In fact, you had to give up a lot of that world to pursue your first passion, which was a passion for social justice and for the opportunity of kids to have those experiences, actually. I guess the outdoor playground at the shelter is also a mini version of that.
Yeah. Yes. You can just see the kids from the first time they show up and give their parents a tour or whatever, and they see that playground. All of a sudden, they're just excited, and we just have to have it because the kids really need outlets, and that really is an outlet, especially during good weather. I think we're fortunate that we have a facility that doesn't look like an institution, and we have nice big backyards, and so there's room for the kids to play. We have a place where the older kids can play basketball and stuff like that. So we have a pretty good setting.
And you even have a neighbor who scolds the kids every now and again.
Yeah, unfortunately, her husband had a stroke, and she's no longer able to live in this house. Her husband's in nursing care. We lost that neighbor, and I called her our watchdog, and she didn't mind being referred to that because she thought, well, no one else can see the backyard from her windows looked out on it, and ours, I'd have to make a trip around to see. She was her helper. She would sometimes help the kids, especially when their ball was coming over into her yard. She didn't always appreciate it if it went over her prized flowers. But then if they were misbehaving, she was on them too,
How much need was there for a family shelter at the beginning?
Predominantly, the people coming to shelter were what a lot of people call transients. And these are usually men that had been living on the street. The first year I was there, we had 15 families the entire year, so that was about once every 3 weeks. And that change and the number of families will skyrocketed that population, not only in Ames but nationwide where studies were done. It was doubling about every 3 years. And so we just kept getting more and more families, and when we got our family area, that worked for a while, and then that wasn't enough room, so we started leasing motel rooms, and that's what we still do. In fact, on a given night, we'll have more families in motel rooms than we have at the shelter, simply because of our lack of space.
Okay. This was the late 80s, then the 90s, welfare reform.
Well, the welfare reform bill, I think it was 1996. I know President Clinton was president then, and I think it was one of the worst things our country ever did. The idea was that we were going to, first of all, do away with a program called Aid to Dependent Children, or ADC back then, which they did. This is something that some hardcore, you might say, right-wing elements had been wanting to do for years, but it wasn't even considered acceptable for either party to even consider. I know President Nixon at that time had actually increased some of the benefits. And then we have this law that, which, you know, because it was proposed by a Democrat, it really flew through. And so we put lifetime limits on how much a parent can get. For instance, in one of our transitional apartments, I remember having a mom with a one-year-old, and then 5 years later, she had met somebody and fallen in love, and this was going to be her true Prince Charming type of romance, and had another kid, and then he took off, which is a tendency, it seems like.
You see that romance played out quite a bit.
Yeah. So her 6-year-old had used up her lifetime eligibility for now. She had no way to even get the diapers or anything. She was really left without anything whatsoever. You know, I couldn't work out a plan on how she could survive. And yet that happened throughout this country. The idea was doing away with welfare. You'd have some work incentive, and so you could get free child care or reduced child care sometimes for 2 years, I believe it was. And the idea was that you would basically force people into becoming self-supporting. But that was predicated on the notion that it was possible to be self-supporting, that there would be jobs, sufficient jobs paying living wages, just a matter of a little training and motivation. Well, that turned out not to be true at all. In fact, the number of jobs paying living wages decreased. They turned it into a political football. And if you want to know the least represented group in this country, it's probably single parents, usually young women with children. They had no political clout whatsoever. And so whenever it comes to budget time, whether it's in Des Moines or in Congress, there'll be people lined up in the hallways, and lobbyists are prolific everywhere. They're all looking for their own little piece of that big pie called our taxes. And but there was very few people advocating for the ones that were really being hurt the most. And that continues to this day.
After many more turns in the road, my conversation with Vic Moss finally turned to his upcoming retirement from the shelter and what he hopes to do then.
There are things that I can do that I can't do now. The shelter, we're not-for-profit. Our lobbying has to be kept to a very minimum, and there are actually changes happening in the entire shelter delivery system in Iowa that make it more and more difficult even to run a shelter. The reporting requirements, you know, I mean, we collect tons of data, but having to get invasive with clients and asking very personal questions that have no bearing on their situation. Oh, here's an example, asking a woman if she's a prostitute. I mean, this is actually in the works right now, and a lot of agencies are doing this, even though, and the idea is that if the answer is affirmative, well, then here's where you go for treatment. Here's an agency here that will shunt you into this group home, you know, for that, when these places don't exist, you know. And that's just one of the things that's happening that's making it harder and harder to do the shelter the way I think it should be done. I think it needs more local awareness of what are we requiring of people. When they're homeless, do they lose all chance of maintaining any dignity themselves? There are other issues. I've got some within my own family, you know, relatives that have issues that I'm involved in right now as far as managing things. And I'm not doing a very good job of this simply because I don't have the time. I've gotten the point age-wise to where just simply juggling this many balls at one time has gotten more difficult. I'll forget an important appointment simply because I forgot that I wrote that on this piece of scratch paper and it never got onto the phone. You know, we're averaging about 50 people a night at the shelter. And every one of them needs a lot of attention, and sometimes they just don't get it. You know, those days, like last week, I was able to spend about half a day getting a mother with 4 children down in a little town south of here, you know, dealing with the other agencies and with the utility company and talking a very irate worker into giving a family one more chance to have a repayment agreement. And being successful at this, you know, is gratifying, and yet I don't have the time for most of this. I could see spending productive time involved with fewer people, but maybe getting more involved. And there are a lot of things happening that really are best done by volunteers. The one that comes to mind right now is volunteers at Food at First that are rescuing several tons of food every week that would be tossed out and putting it back in the system, you might say, and going to families that need that kind of help. And so I know that having more time available for some other activities, and there are issues on predatory lending, which I've been involved in and actually helped a group get a certain type of that made illegal in Iowa, but it's still an awful issue that families that are hurting the most are the most desperate and least likely to maybe make the best decision, but they're getting pulled into this debt treadmill where they're actually paying higher rates in some cases than the loan sharks that were in the mafia used to charge. This is an issue I'd love to have more time, because I know a few people targeting the subcommittees in the houses in Des Moines at the right time. And I've sat there right with the people that came up from Georgia that were the chief lobbyists for this industry and saw how the system works. And a few people can make a big impact. We got car title lending made illegal in Iowa. And, I mean, that took the Des Moines Register doing a real good story about one of our families, as a matter of fact. So when you see what can be done by a few people that are organized, I mean, the lobbyists have known this forever, but most people don't realize that you just don't write a letter to your senator, because most issues never even get as far as them. These things happen in subcommittees. We have to decide what is permissible for, and we are a rich country, what can we live with ourselves? First of all, we have to acknowledge a problem, and that's what I hope programs like this can help people understand. And then we have to decide what's the best way to solve this. And there, every now and then you'll hear creative ideas like the tiny house movement. It probably wouldn't meet present zoning laws in the community, but I think we have to relook at then what is our zoning laws doing? You know, how much of our zoning rules increase the cost of housing? If we don't solve these, we're saying that it's permissible in this country for children to be huddled in a cold car on a freezing night because they have no place to live, and all their stuff was put out on the curb, and the sheriff was there to make sure that the locks got changed, you know.
Come back to the topic of children, which we started with and which you started with as a young man entering the workforce as a child abuse investigator at Department of Human Services and then as a counselor at a residential home. I thank you for sitting down this afternoon and taking a long view over your history in this field. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to add?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And when you ask about my plans for the future, you know, I've talked about myself, but my wife has, you know, we started the shelter as a couple. Without her being there, we wouldn't exist today, because I could have never made it, you know. And so she was spending a lot of hours, and we had two children born the first 2 years we were there, and they pretty much grew up, at least until they were in, well into grade school, living there with us. And so it was a team effort, you know. And at one point she had to get another job just to support the shelter, you know, because so we had enough to meet our own budget, you might say. And so, you know, we started out that way. Now she's a special ed teacher, and some of the facts I give in most talks, I get the data from her, because she'll tell me how much poverty affects her kids. And so that's part of her plans. They're going to have some things that we've put off for years, you know, that she's been wanting to do. And so we'll be doing other things besides, you know, just doing the shelter stuff.
Well, the community is so grateful to you for your years of service, and I suppose you have a few more months of that, and then you'll be on your own doing these things together with your wife, and we wish you very well.
Well, thank you for the chance to do this morning.
And that was Vic Moss in his 29th year as Director of Emergency Residence Project in Ames. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with the story of Mason City's buy-in to a new 10,000-kill pork processing plant owned by the Prestige family, and its citizens' outrage that the deal seems to have been mostly completed without them. I then was joined by two Ames residents, Mary Ross and Carol Helland, to talk about Days for Girls, which is happening tomorrow evening at St. Cecilia Church. Finally, I shared my conversation with Vic Moss. Coming up on KHOI, a whole morning of good music with Paul Hertz playing classical tunes and Hollis Monroe spinning jazz. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Nadia Abdelazim. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Love Hurts by the Everly Brothers. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.